Accession number 19990, reel 5.
Chief Technician Roper, reel 5. You were telling me about the Lone Ranger operations, flights over Eastern Europe. What more do you know about those?
Well, not a great deal. I think they were hush-hush. And we just knew that these aircraft disappeared for sort of hours on end and came back the following day, and you sort of knew that they'd been somewhere into Eastern Europe. And I assume that they were surveying or sort of doing the jobs that the Americans later tried to do with sort of problems with the Russians. But it had all, as far as I know, the RAF had done theirs much earlier on.
Do you know how you got to know this? Was it in any official or regular way that you...
No. It possibly came out long after the event, because there were certain... Some of the squadrons had certain roles, and others didn't appear to have, that type of job. And they, I think, were the ones that did the... I think it was called the Lone Rangers. It was a long flight, and... over Eastern Europe. And then there was a number of exercises, presumably with NATO, because I can remember one of the aircraft was cut in half by an Italian fighter who dived on the top aircraft and then went underneath it and cut another one in half over, I think it was over Frankfurt, but I know we lost a Lincoln. And of course in those days you had the occasional accident where they had to pull the undercarriage up on landing because of brake failures and things. But to lose one in flying was unusual.
So you're not really sure whether you knew at the time that these are...
What they were doing, but I think it was possibly later that we found out what they'd been up to, yeah.
I mean... speaking as an engine technician, is it possible to tell from inspecting the engine whether it's been going on long flights or short flights and whether it's been operating at high altitude or low altitude?
No.
There's no
I mean,
physical sign of that?
No, the aircraft disappeared. They might have gone sort of up to Scotland or something and stayed overnight and came back, so there was no way of knowing. I mean, you had to record the flying hours. And so had you been observant and sort of said, well, this has flown 30 hours in a matter of, say, 36 hours, then you knew it had probably been on a long haul somewhere. But you wouldn't generally know that the thing had been sort of any great distance.
Did you ever have to deal with an aircraft that showed any signs of damage that might have been inflicted by air defence?
No. I'm sure we would have, that sort of thing would have spread around like wildfire if there were bullet holes in it or anything like that.
Going on from that, in more general terms, were you politically conscious of what was going on in Europe, of the developments in the Cold War and in international relations at the time?
No, not really. I don't know, quite know what conflicts. Malaya had... we had aircraft that had been out in Malaya. We had aircraft that had been out with the Mau Mau operations. And you tended to only know the sort of active theatres, not about the Cold War at all. It was the sort of... probably the Middle East and the situation in the Middle East. Cyprus was developing into a hotspot in around 1954, and those were the sort of things we heard about, people being posted to units where there was trouble.
You weren't interested in what was going on in Europe and Germany along the inner German border,
No, we were more involved with postings that were to areas which were active. So I don't You know, I don't recall having worried about Europe at all at that time.
Were you at all aware of developments in atomic strategy at that time, which were...
No.
...places the V-bomb, of course?
No, we had aircraft with some sophisticated equipment on, because there were cameras on the same unit. And there were certain items of equipment on the camera where the aircraft had to be guarded, and it was hush-hush at the time. And sort of we knew that this thing was something special. But with the old Lincoln, and I think we had the occasional Hastings, you know, they were old hat, although there was some very sophisticated equipment in some of the Lincolns, which later, of course, went into things like the Comet and the Nimrod.
Would this be radar systems?
Yes, mainly.
Downward-looking radar systems as well as...
I'm not sure because it's not in my area, but we had a squadron that did all the radar jamming with window and other equipment. And there was one squadron did the jamming, the other squadron sorted out the jamming, and you know, it was quite important work. Yep.
Were there any developments in the actual engines, in the Merlin engines, while you were working on them?
No. They, they were tried and tested. They'd been, at the time, the later of the engines was the Griffin that was in the Shackleton, of course, and Merlins were 10 a penny. I mean, we had a lot of aircraft that were in storage down at Upwood, and if we ever had an aircraft that was categorised as beyond repair through corrosion and cracking of spars and things like that, we used to have to go down and pick another one from the heap at Upwood, and they used to try and sell you some of the sort of dodgy ones, and we had a little airframe sergeant whose job it was to go down and pick the best of the bunch and bring it back.
Was it the case that airframes failed before engines did, or was it the other way around usually?
No, I mean, an engine will go on to its reconditioning life, which probably would be 800 hours. And so as the aircraft flew along, the engine, if it reached its 800 hours, was just taken out and sent back to Rolls-Royce or East Kilbride to be reconditioned. You quite often got an engine failure where either a valve would go through a piston or something like this, and it had to be removed premature, and it would go back for repair or reconditioning. But the airframe soldiered on sort of 10,000 hours or what have you. And we had an aircraft that you could find anything up to about 110 cracks in a main plane on the top skin. And the riggers were sort of fairly busy doing repairs, insertion repairs. And we... on slack times, used to have to knuckle under and sort of help them. And
so you learned rigging on the job?
Well, no, you wouldn't call it rigging. It was sort of...
Patching,
and anybody could do it. And, of course, the aircraft wasn't a high-speed aircraft with a high-speed finish. So, I mean, in some cases, I would think they just slapped... they drilled the ends of the crack and slapped a plate over the top. Whereas an insertion repair should be flush with the surface, you'd just have a patch. In fact, some of the cracks had been covered up by modaplin, is it the fabric? You know, they used to just patch fabric over the top to hide it until it got into the hangar, and then when you pulled all this stuff off underneath, there was all sorts of things going on. And, of course, the corrosion. I've watched people just flicking rivet heads off with the thumbnail sort of right the way up a line, you know, and they just go to powder, and it was, I think, intercrystalline corrosion.
What causes that? Intercrystalline corrosion?
Well, salt will do it.
Yeah.
I suppose age. But, I mean, always around the toilet area on aircraft, any spillage, and it just rots big holes in the skin, you know, acid, any sort of acid. I mean, if you let any mercury spill in an aircraft and you don't know it's happened, you go back and it's like a Christmas tree, you know, it really has a reaction to anything like mercury, which... there's quite a lot of mercury used in instruments and testing equipment, but mercury can sort of write an aircraft off if it gets in the wrong place.
Presumably, if you're talking about salt, you'd get that if you were flying over the sea.
Low over the sea with sort of a sea haze, which is salt laden. I mean, this with helicopters, or even landing near the sea. I believe that during Suez, half the helicopters were written off by just landing on beaches near the water. And the corrosion, the American helicopters, or the Whirlwind, the forerunner of the Whirlwind, they were all mag alloy. And it just rotted it completely off. And later they changed the skin to duralumin because it was sort of, well, thicker and less prone to corrosion.
What material was used mainly in the skin of the Lincoln? Was this aluminium of some sort?
The cowlings on a Lincoln were about a quarter of an inch thick. They were very, very strong covers. You could stand on the top of the engines, and it wasn't just a flimsy covering, sort of, you had the Zeus fasteners and things. But the top of the engines, it was about a quarter of an inch thick. And then you had slightly thinner panels that were well-ribbed. To nail round the sides, but they were we used to get some corrosion from the exhaust emissions. They used to leave sort of sooty trails all the way down the wing behind the engine, and but there wouldn't have been much corrosion there.
What metal was it? Was it a type of aluminium?
It would be duralumin, I would think, because
what's duralumin?
It's an aluminium alloy, basic, mainly aluminium. I'm not sure what the other ingredient it is, but it's not as pliable as aluminium. It's more rigid, and it tends to be to snap if you you know, it doesn't.
Hasn't got flexibility.
No.
Say that the aluminium
Duralumin. Duralumin, yeah.
Used to make the skin of the Lincoln was more rigid than normal aluminium, but it also snapped more easily.
It's harder wearing. Aluminium will corrode more readily. Is easier to bend and form if you're making curves and the like. You see, but. The duralumin has a treatment which gives it a nice hard surface, but as I say, if you had to choose a material to work with, the aluminium is far better to work with.
More malleable.
Yeah.
Now, you're mentioning reconditioning of engines.
Mm-hmm.
How many times would an engine be restored and reconditioned before it had to be scrapped?
It's never really scrapped. You see, each part of the engine has a life. The crankshaft might be lifed at a finite life of 3,000 hours. Now, if the engine that it's in does 600 hours and then has to come out for reconditioning or repair, It's stripped down, and each of the components is sent through a inspection process, crack detection and so on, and check for wear. And then there would be a marking put on that component had done 600 hours. Now, then it could be put on a shelf, and along comes a chap who's building an engine, and he just takes this any old crankshaft off the shelf. He looks at its life, and it says this has done 600 hours, and he's putting it in for another into an engine that's going to be nil hours. So he puts it in. In 800 hours' time, the engine's taken out again. That crankshaft comes into the shop, is examined, and they stamp plus 800 on it. So it's now got 1,400, you see. Now, eventually, it's getting to near its finite life. It's probably only got 400 hours left of its life. And they get an engine in that's on a repair that has only got 400 hours to run in its cycle of 800. So they'll pop this old crankshaft in, but when it comes in 400 hours' time, that's thrown away. And so major components are lifed all differently, and that's the way it's done. Because when you take an engine apart, if you find a serious flaw, you just change that one bit and put one in, and it might be a second-hand bit.
Was this process controlled? Was there someone who was keeping a note of what parts you'd got in stock and what sort of life they got on?
Well, yes.
A register, so you could match up suitable parts to suitable parts. Was it done ad hoc by the chap going in and seeing what was on the shelf?
No. There are log cards. I mean, they'd never issue you with a part that had less than the life of an engine, the 800 hours between overhauls. They'd never issue a part where halfway through you'd have to take it off because it was time X. Although certain components, the propeller, for instance, stuck on the front of the engine, that might have a lock card which says it's due to be changed in 200 hours. The engine could have a pump on it, a hydraulic pump, and that has a lock card. And these are all in the aircraft. Well, in those days, the 700, you had a page which told you all the components and what life they had to go, and these were marked. And so at the nearest convenient inspection, which in most cycles, they have daily inspections, then they probably have a primary or a primary star or a primary two star before coming up for the minor inspection. And at the nearest inspection, this item would be noted that it had to be changed in 70 hours' time, 80 hours' time. And sort of the engineering officer would look at the workload and it'd say, well, we'll extend that, we'll give it a 10% extension if there was no problems, to bring it to a slightly bigger inspection where it would be more convenient, because sometimes you'd probably have to take the engine out to get at the bit that you want it to change, and that in itself was probably 2 or 3 days' work just to get at something that needed to be changed.
And what about the propellers? How long did they last?
A propeller had probably a life of 1,000 hours. They quite often they develop leaks because there's all the blades, because they move, they've got seals and seals wear, and when you consider that at high altitude they're running at near freezing conditions, so you could have damage through striking birds or anything like this. You picked up stones when they were being ground run, so you kept an eye on it. Also, they had anti-icing on some propellers, and these used to sort of suffer damage. So it was regularly inspected, but a propeller was sort of taken off and taken to a bay and stripped down and cleaned up and resealed, and Of course, the blades are usually finely balanced, so you'd have to send it back for balancing if there was any major problem. But no, that's the way it just works that way.
How long would it take to do a minor inspection when you were doing one?
It would take possibly the engine fitters a week to complete their work. It would take the riggers 10 days to do theirs. A lot depended on if you had additional manpower, and if you had other work other than the basic minor inspection. A lot depended on how many men you had to sort of extra to do the additional jobs.
What about the major inspections? If a major inspection went, to a normal...
Oh, that would probably be almost double the minor inspection. Probably take us 10 days and the riggers 3 weeks. There's an awful lot of component changing on a major, and there's a lot of things that wouldn't normally be. You probably have to take out the fuel tanks to examine them and check the tank bays and things like this. A lot of an additional work.
What were your domestic arrangements like when you were at Helmswell? The accommodation and food and...
Well, we were in a standard H block. These are the type of barrack blocks built just pre-war. Most stations have got H blocks that were sort of wartime bomber stations. 8 rooms, with the centrepiece of the H forming drying rooms, toilets, bathrooms, showers, etc. Quite comfortable. The rooms probably held all 14 or 16 men. There was a bunk for the NCO. Some of the rooms had bunk beds in the corners, so you could get two in the bed space of one. But they were quite comfortable, parquet flooring, well heated. And I don't think there's much I can add to that. My old barrack block is now a flea market at Helmswell. It's now an antique centre.
Did you have to go through room inspections and kit inspections as you...
Oh, started? Yes, yes. There would be a check kept probably weekly by the squadron admin personnel, but once a month there was certainly the CO's inspection, and probably once every 2 or 3 months there'd be the station commander's inspection. And once a year, of course, the AOC would inspect, and it was a fairly high standard.
Did you also have inspections of your professional gear, your tool kit and things like that, to make sure they were in order?
On occasions, because each man had a tool kit, he was expected to ensure that it was he hadn't lost anything. Now, later on, they found that people were losing tools. If you had an aircraft and it did a loop and a pair of pliers fell out onto the pilot and things, it caused a lot of ructions. So they then decided that giving people toolkits was not any longer a good idea. Because we had tools that we'd bought ourselves, special tools. Yes, which we could do the job a lot easier than... Because the RAF toolkits in the early days were very basic tools, whereas if you got yourself some of these American spanners and locking wire pliers and the like, these you kept in your toolkit. But...
Where did you get those from? Did you buy them from catalogues, or did you go to specialist shops for them?
Well, you often served on units where there was Americans, and for instance, on the Merlin, the American plug spanner was a snap-on plug spanner, and it was very good to work on any plug. And so you often find that a man has got a Merlin plug spanner and he's working on a Centaurus or another piston-engined aircraft because this thing is such a beautiful tool to use. They were, as I say, they were comfortable. And the it was the days of national servicemen, and the young national servicemen used to like to get away at weekends because a lot of them live locally, and so they could get off from Saturday lunchtime till Sunday evening. I lived in, by this time, my parents lived in London or in the London area, and so I didn't go home very often. We didn't have a lot of money. I think I was on about £5 a week, and it was usually paid on Wednesday, broke on Thursday.
What did the money go on?
Well, one good night out in Lincoln, and sort of a number of naffy breaks, because the naffy was quite a useful building, because you couldn't afford to go out to Lincoln more than once a week. And so we'd spend the evenings in the naffy, sort of, there was games rooms and television.
It does sound as though it was a rather self-contained community on the social.
Oh yes, because a lot of RAF stations are in rural, naturally in rural country areas. And so there wasn't really a lot to do locally. I mean, you could walk into the village pub at Hemswell, and I don't know if you know the road into Lincoln, which is the A15. Well, there was K&B Corner, which was a sort of local hostelry. But people tended to stay on the camp.
What were your relations with the local population like in the villages and the village pubs?
Mine were very good, although you didn't... I mean, we had civilians from the villages that worked on the station in various capacities, but because I was on the station every weekend, mainly because I couldn't afford or it was too long a distance to go home... the local rugby teams, we used to play the local rugby teams, but also play for them. So at weekends, usually on a Saturday afternoon, I was opted to by one of the national servicemen who lived in Market Raisin. He played for his small town, and he used to take sort of some of us to keep the team up to strength, because they were mainly schoolmasters and locals from Market Raisin that were the team. But we used to play all the fairly good local teams, Lincoln and Grimsby. I remember Grimsby was a good match. So, yeah, we integrated in with village life quite well.
You mentioned the National Servicemen. Did they live in the same accommodations you did?
Oh, yes. And of course, a lot of them were very interesting people. I had a junior technician in my room who was, he'd just got his degree in mathematics, and he was a miner's son, and he'd spent sort of 4 or 5 years at university, and his parents had sort of helped to pay his way. And no sooner had he got his degree than he had to come into the Air Force for 2 years on national service. And he had a big chip on his shoulder because he wanted to be earning money to pay his parents back what they'd invested in him. And whilst he was doing his 2 years, he took his master's and got that. But he was very bitter about the fact that he was there and really on fairly low pay. A long way from home, so a lot of his pay would go on transportation if he wanted to go home for any length of time. But we also had some, there was one lad who was a civil engineer, and he used his time productively. He bought an old car, and over the 2 years that he had to serve, he restored this car to something that was worth quite a lot of money and drove out of the gates when he got his demob. Another lad was a tailor, and he used to come up from London with bolts of cloth and make suits all week. Once again, being national service, not a lot of money, But a lot of them did well out of the service, making the most of their time. And certainly I think that they benefited by a little bit of the discipline. And
I was asking about whether you were mixed in, because I wondered whether you actually lived in units and subunits, or whether you were just put into the barrack blocks at random when vacancies...
Oh, no, you tended because...